Ephesus was a rich, a busy port. It was a city. That'll help if you switch it on, I think. And it ought to help. There we are. It sits there on the edge of Turkey, and it's just one of the cities where Paul planted a church, and it used to be a magnificent city, as I say, that there's this rich, busy, proud port. It was also the home of the fertility goddess Artemis, and there was this big temple devoted to her, and there were statues all over the place of her, a fairly grotesque statue, this turreted head, and because she was a fertility goddess, had all these breasts on her. And this, the worship of Artemis generated a lot of income for the city of Ephesus. Firstly, through the tourist worshippers who came to Ephesus because the temple was there and they wanted to worship, and so they came and they brought their money, and just like tourism works today, it worked then. But also because the tourists came and would buy the miniature statues of the goddess Artemis. And so the craftspeople, particularly the silversmiths, did great trade by selling these to the tourists, the worship tourists. Sadly, the kind of river, the harbor that serviced Ephesus started silting up. And as it started silting up, the ships were no longer able to come in. And so the economy of the city started to decline. And this meant that Ephesus became more and more dependent on these tourist worshippers. Paul founded the church at Ephesus. And as you read through Acts chapter 19, you'll see that Ephesus was kind of birthed in opposition, and there was opposition seemingly throughout its history. When Paul first went there, he was preaching in a particular building for 3 months, and there were converts, but then there was kind of uprisings, and he had to change to a different venue, taking the Christians, those who accepted Jesus, with him. And as more and more people became Christians in Ephesus, there was an unexpected consequence. Trade in the Artemis statues started to decline significantly. The people were becoming Christians, they were turning away from Artemis worship, and so not only were they not worshipping in the temple, but neither were they buying these little statues. And this went on, and it went on to such an extent that the silversmiths rioted. They wanted Paul out. They wanted to stop this nonsense about preaching about Christianity, because it was impacting on their pockets, because people, when they accepted Jesus, they were leaving this Artemis worship. And so obviously, even though there was opposition, or dare I say, maybe because of the opposition, the Christians who were planted there were strong, and the hostility continued. After 2 years, Paul left Ephesus, and he had other churches to plant, and he left Timothy in charge of the church there. Paul was arrested, he was put under house arrest. Later, he was released, but he was rearrested, probably at a place called Troas. And from there, as we have been seeing, he was taken to that prison, that Mamertine prison in Rome, where he was put into that rather horrible dungeon. And that's where he is now, and it's from there that he's writing this letter. He knows that he's going to go to court. He knows that he's going to be found guilty. He knows that he's going to die by being beheaded, because he's a Roman citizen. They gave him the dignity of being beheaded rather than crucified. And he's sitting in that dungeon, and he's missing his friends, and especially he's missing Timothy. And so he writes to Timothy. And as I said at the beginning, it's a letter. And as I have been saying, as you read this letter, you can sense the sadness of Paul as he writes the letter. And while he's in prison, he gets word from Ephesus. And the news is not good news. People have come into the church, and they have been preaching false doctrine. And he tells Timothy that their teaching will spread like gangrene. And among them, maybe these were two leaders in the church, Hymenaeus and Philetus. they too have departed from the truth. We don't know who they were, but they were important enough for Paul to mention. They were undermining everything that Paul had done. They were undermining the doctrine. They were undermining the truth. And more than that, you know that everyone in the province of Asia has deserted me, including Phygellus and Hermogenes, another two people that we don't know any more of, but clearly they had been leaders and been supporters of Paul and what he had done. They too had left Paul. Why are they deserting? Well, among other reasons, it seems like this last arrest where Paul is in this Marmatan prison had something to do with it. And so he pleads with Timothy. He says, "Do not be ashamed of the testimony about our Lord or of me, his prisoner, but join with me in suffering for the gospel by the power of God." Join with me in suffering for the gospel. And as we saw last week, the gospel for which Paul is suffering is an amazing gospel. It's worth suffering for. Paul then connects his faithfulness in proclaiming the gospel to his suffering and his imprisonment. He says to Timothy, "That is why I am suffering as I am." Yet this is no cause for shame. Timothy, Paul seems to be saying, the false teachers are active in the church in Ephesus. Timothy, people that I thought were faithful to the gospel, who were faithful to me and my teaching, they have deserted me. Can you hear what he's saying? He's saying, Timothy, are you going to desert me too? Timothy, please don't desert me also. But in the darkness, almost a physical darkness in that cell, but certainly an emotional and a spiritual darkness as well, there was a ray of light in Paul's life. And his name was Onesiphorus. Yes, everyone deserted me, but not Onesiphorus. He often refreshed me. And he was not ashamed of my chains. On the contrary, when he was in Rome, he searched for me until he found me. While others were busy deserting Paul, it seems that Onesiphorus had actually traveled from Ephesus all the way to Rome looking for Paul. And when he did find Paul going from prison to prison to prison, he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of Paul's change. Now, the refreshing could be an emotional refreshing. It could be a spiritual refreshing. It could also have included an economic refreshing, because prisoners, many of them in the prisons then, were responsible for their own upkeep. And so it may have been that Onesiphorus was giving Paul food and stuff to drink as well. But in fact, for Paul, the biggest blessing seems that here was a man who wasn't ashamed of the gospel, who wasn't ashamed of Paul's chains, and was willing to look through the prison system until he finds Paul. And so here's the question. If showing such caring interest can be such an encouragement to someone who's struggling, ready for the question? To whom are we and Onesiphorus? To whom are we and Onesiphorus? Just think for a moment. Think about people you know. And just allow the Lord to nudge you towards a name. Is there someone who may appreciate our encouragement right now? Someone who may need our input right now? It may be economic input. It may be simply listening with a non-judgmental ear. It may be an email from time to time, just assuring them that you are praying for them. Now, Onesiphorus was not Paul's mentor, like he's now the stronger guy who's kind of helping Paul. No, 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 no. Paul probably led Onesiphorus to the Lord when he planted the church in Ephesus. So it doesn't have to be someone that kind of you think that, you know, well, I'm senior to them. No, it's anybody, even if they're older than you and been a Christian for longer than you. Paul here represents anyone who needs encouragement. And Onesiphorus was willing to be God's instrument to give it. To whom are we and are Nephi for us? As I was thinking about this, and particularly after our ministry leaders meeting on Thursday evening, where it came up that the one thing that people would want more of is a sense of community, of family. And it occurred to me that if we are going to accomplish the Lord's purpose for our church, to go to our vision and mission, if we are going to serve our community by presenting Christ in a relevant and authentic way, if we are going to do that, I think we're going to need a greater involvement with one another. You see, our temptation, and it might not be conscious, is to absorb the prevailing culture. And the prevailing culture is one of individualism. And that, may I say, is not a biblical culture. The biblical culture is one of community, of family. Timothy's, representing younger, growing Christians. Timothy's need a Paul. Timothy's need a more mature Christian to help them and to guide them. But as we saw this morning, even older, more mature Christians, like Paul, need an Onesiphorus to help them, to encourage them, to re-excite in them the freshness, the excitement of the gospel. Remember those questions that we were left to consider a couple of weeks back? They were printed again in the bulletin last Sunday morning. I think those are important questions, and I think that we ought to be considering them. And I do think a good place to consider those questions might be one evening in our Bible study groups. Because as we talk about them, we will get support from people who know and love us, and they will help us be accountable to what we're doing with those questions. We as individuals, we as a church wanting to serve our community, we all need support. We all need accountability as we engage in the lives of our church family so that we can look beyond our gates and serve our community. Paul, sitting in that prison and all that he was experiencing, it wasn't unique to Paul. What Paul and Timothy needed to be effective is also what we need to be effective. I know that we are not pioneer church planters or anything like that. I know that. But some of the stuff that Paul was doing and some of what Timothy was doing, those form part of the kinds of things that we should be doing. You see, we have this amazing salvation which we saw last week. We have been justified, past tense. We are being sanctified, present tense. We can look forward to being glorified, future tense. And that amazing salvation, as I suggested last week, could leave us speechless. That God has given all this to us. And we have a great privilege in knowing this gospel, this good deposit, which Paul speaks about in verse 14, with which we have been entrusted. And that's important. It's a deposit. And we have been entrusted with this deposit of this amazing gospel. But that brings with it an obligation of this gospel, says Paul. I was appointed a herald and an apostle and a teacher. Having the gospel brings with it an obligation. And for Paul, it was a threefold obligation. An apostle. I just want to get something clear. There are no more apostles in the world today, not biblical apostles. I know that there are people who say they are apostles. I know that there are churches who say that they've got apostles. But I want to say that when the 12 apostles died, that kind of apostleship died with them. To have been an apostle like Paul was an apostle, you needed to have been physically with Jesus. You need to have put into Scripture all that Jesus did and taught. And so when those called to be apostles wrote about the things that Jesus did and put it kind of into doctrine for us, what they communicated was universally applicable to the whole church. No one today can claim to have a new revelation from God that is universally applicable to the whole church. There are no more apostles in the world today. Don't let somebody fool you with that. But Paul could say, I was appointed an apostle. Now that we cannot relate to, okay? I accept that. But that's not all Paul was. Paul was also appointed as a herald. And that is something we ought to be able to relate to. Being a herald is something we should embrace. What is a herald? Well, let's cast our mind back a couple of centuries and think about the town crier. These are the people who came and stood in the town square and they made an announcement. They were not at liberty to change in any way the message that they were announcing. They simply announced, heralded the news. The message of the gospel has been entrusted to us and we are heralds. We are to announce the gospel. To be sure, we must announce the gospel in a way that is relevant and authentic to those to whom we announce it, but we can't change it. I was once on one of the interview panels for seminary graduates wanting ministerial recognition. And the one candidate who came in caused me to do a double take. There he was with his long hair, earrings, studs. I used to call them tattoos, but it's body art today. As I say, I took a double take. I was also hoping this morning to be able to give you an impression of the way he spoke. Hey, not my brew, I can't. He'd done 4 years at seminary. He wanted to be accredited as a minister. You see, he was working in a church in Jeffreys Bay. And his work was among the young surfers and the young skateboarders. He could not change the gospel message, but talk about presenting the gospel in a way that was relevant and authentic to those to whom he was heralding it. We are heralds. We have no liberty to change the message. Paul was a herald. Timothy was a herald. My JBA ministerial candidate was a herald. I am a herald. You are a herald. We must announce the gospel. And we must be creative in the way we announce it. I think it was about 18 months ago, you will remember, Lee Robinson was here and he had that woman with him who was at the top of her field in the BBC. And she gave her testimony. And she used to live in the same street as the manse, the Beach Road or Beachway, a couple of doors up from where Lee and his wife Irene were living at the time. Irene was instrumental in leading this woman to the Lord. Remember how Irene creatively presented the gospel to her? She baked a cake and knocked on her door and presented her with a cake. The gospel message was heard loud and clear through her loving care for that woman. Oh, I don't know what to say, people tell me. Well, don't say a word. Live it. I led a person to the Lord in Stellenbosch once and then baptized him. And I want to tell you that certainly at the beginning I didn't say too much. I simply made an appointment to regularly go for a bicycle ride with this guy. Oh, it was an intentional ride. I was aware of him and what he was saying and what the Lord was nudging me to do. But that was it. I rode my bicycle with him. Creative way of being present for the Lord to use you to herald the gospel. We are, like Paul, heralds. We have no liberty to change the message, but we must be creative to present the message in a way that is relevant and authentic to those to whom we are presenting it. I was appointed a herald, says Paul, and so are we. But he says, I was also appointed a teacher. And this could, in this context, refer to the office of teacher in the church. And of course, not all of us are teachers in that sense of the word. But as we saw a couple of weeks ago, all of us ought to be able to explain why we believe what we believe. We must be able to give an intelligent account of the way of salvation. So there's a sense that we are all teachers. But to be a teacher, we need to become students. Students of the Bible. Notice how Paul then connects being a herald and a teacher with the next verse. That is why I'm suffering as I am, yet this is no cause for shame. Because he was a herald, because he was a teacher, because he was faithful doing that, that is why I am suffering. But because it's an amazing gospel for which he's suffering, he's not ashamed. Now, suffering for Paul meant imprisonment. Suffering for Christians where ISIS dominates is death. Direct correlation between following Christ and suffering. As faithful heralds and teachers of the gospel, what does suffering mean for us? And I guess the question really is, do we suffer? It's a serious question. Do we suffer for the gospel? Do we suffer because we are faithfully living as Christians? And as my mind went through our folk here in the congregation, I'm not sure that we do suffer physically because we are Christians. And what we do suffer, it's like embarrassing to mention it in the same sentence as those who are living in ISIS-dominated territories. Can't really put them in the same category, the suffering. And yet let me speak about myself. My suffering extends no further than foregoing things that I could afford if I stopped giving to the Lord's work. That's my suffering. My suffering extends no further than foregoing activities which would keep me from worship on a Sunday. It's my suffering. My suffering extends no further than getting home from a day at the office and just wanting to park. But I've got a Bible study. So I drag my body out and I go to the... That's my suffering. My suffering extends no further than wanting to keep my Saturday to myself, but feeling, there's a work party at the church. I better go. Am I really suffering? Well, not really. But if I think I am, that's the extent of it. That's the extent of it. What about you? Think of your life as a Christian. Can you relate even in some small way to Paul's statements? That is why I'm suffering as I am, yet I'm not ashamed. I think it's clear, by and large, our lives are not threatened because we are Christians. And I don't want us to feel embarrassed by that, because we are here because this is where God has put us. We don't go looking for suffering. But because we are here, it means we have unique opportunities to be heralds and teachers. We can still share our testimony with people without fear of physical reprisal. We can still come freely and worship without fear of physical reprisal. So, all I'm saying, let's take stock of our Christian lives, because we are so privileged, because we have so much to be thankful for. Let's take stock of what we are doing for the Lord. You see, no matter what happens to us, and this is the wonderful thing, no matter what happens to us, our eternal destiny is secure. Because our eternal destiny is based not on our ability to remain faithful. Our eternal destiny is based firstly on God having called us. And God called us not because of something that we have done, but He called us for His own purpose and grace. And secondly, our eternal destiny is based on God's ability to guard our commitment to Him. I know whom I have believed and am convinced that He is able to guard what I've committed to Him until the day. My eternal destiny doesn't rest in my ability to hold on to Him. My eternal destiny rests on His commitment to God, my commitment to Him. My eternal destiny is secure. Nothing will keep me from God's love and presence. Which means surely, if I'm asked to suffer, which probably for us is mild discomfort, leaving my comfort zone, surely I can do that. See, here's a question with which I'd like to leave you. What is our Christianity costing us? Let's spend a few moments in silence.